It can be daunting to try to take what you've got in terms of money and make it more. There's a dizzying array of options out there for places to put your money and the promises they make or don't about what your money can do. And then there's the basic difficulty of thinking about things that may be decades away. A new book seeks to remove some of the difficulty by laying out some basic options and easily digestible text and graphics. That is the book Wealth by Virtue, the work of Chad Gordon, who's the founder and CEO of an investment advisory company in Colorado, where he advises people on decisions about making the most of their money. Chad Gordon, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Very good to have you. The book is getting some awards, I notice, along with a lot of good reviews. In your blurb, I've never seen the term holistic financial planning. What is that?
Okay. Well, that is in the blurb. I think I was talking about more my own practice. But in the book, what I am highlighting in there is that wealth must only be built on a comprehensive way. So the book, I have it structured around what I call the six areas of finance. So this would be the holistic approach. They'd be banking, investments, real estate, insurance, legal planning, and tax planning. And when you take all those into a whole, your wealth works together for you to grow.
Well, when you look around, though, I mean, there are libraries full of books, there are thinner publications, all kinds of websites, and a couple of TV channels devoted to investing advice.
Sure.
Why write this book?
Sure. Well, I thought that there was that it really hadn't been approached in quite this way before. Usually, if you go to these books, they're going to fall on one end of the spectrum or the other. And on one end, they tend to be a little bit more of the money for idiots kind of approach, where it's very, very, very simple and very boiled down almost to a condescending degree. And there's nothing wrong with that per se, but I usually find that people are more in the middle. They don't want to go on the far end, on the academic side of looking at things. They're just trying to find something that really educates them, and they walk away with something of value, no matter where they are in life and no matter what they know. And so my approach is to give people a comprehensive framework so that they can make financial decisions off of it.
So whence comes the term wealth by virtue? I mean, it's a very pretty book, and even the cover shows a bull and a bear enjoying the night sky together. It almost looks like
sure.
a children's book on that level.
It does. Right. It doesn't look like an obvious thing. The bull and the bear, there's two questions there. The bull and the bear, it's symbolic more of a buy and hold approach, where the bull and bear are friends, and the only way to enjoy the upside of the bull is to embrace the downside of the bear, to not fear it. The title Wealth by Virtue is a twofold thing. One is that I believe that wealth can be achieved by traditional virtues of patience, faith, having optimism, and some of those traditional virtues that we all hear about. But then the other aspect of it is having virtue in your wealth, is that money is, the old adage of money doesn't buy happiness. But beyond that, it's easy to get caught up and to have money poison your mindset and to lose sight of the important things of life. That ultimately, financial security to me is all about freeing up your mind to enjoy the real things of life, of family and friends, and finding your own personal calling.
I mentioned that this is a very colorful book. I mean, it's got all sorts of illustrations and charts and graphs, which makes me wonder if people do get easily bored talking about the devices of earning money through investments.
Oh, I imagine so. I think, yeah, most books are going to be in black and white. If there are charts, they're going to be black and white charts. So when we were creating it, I was really adamant on creating a full-color book, which I had a lot of publisher kickback. I'm not doing it that way because it's more expensive.
Sure.
But my belief is that the full color really aids in the education. Money and numbers usually intimidate a lot of people. So that's the regrettable thing is even if you're intimidated by it, you have to deal with it whether you want to or not. And so what I'm seeking to do is to really make the teaching as digestible and as understandable and as friendly, for lack of a better word, as possible.
Well, you score points for making it easier to follow columns by having them in different colors. I mean, as they skip from one page to the next, it's like, oh, wait, I'm still in the blue column. I know where I am.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So the way that I did it was each of those six areas of finance that I mentioned a few minutes ago, they each have a color-coordinated thing. So you can see it along the spine. So each chapter you're in is in it. But even throughout it, I have subtle messaging. So when I'm talking about taxes, everything is in purple, and it's, I believe that subliminally it helps the information sink in.
So let's talk about those six sections again: banking, investments, real estate, insurance, legal planning, and tax planning. I mean, can you get really good at one or two of these and push the rest aside?
No, I think it's very difficult for anyone to get really good at even one of them. I mean, perhaps banking would be the easiest, but usually what I find that most people will learn a lot about something and then move on in life back to their real lives. And I speak about the importance of hiring professionals and how to choose professionals. So for example, if you're buying a house, you're going to learn all about mortgages and escrow and homeowners insurance and all those things. And then life moves on from that. And you don't, most people don't typically think about it too much. Or maybe they'll have a parent pass away and they see the importance of estate planning, so they'll get a trust set up, and then they never really look back at it again. So what I'm thinking to do is to keep the momentum going and to, instead of thinking that you'll be an expert in all of it, is to have a good mental framework for which you can hire professionals to fill in that framework with true expertise.
There's a section that really riveted my attention in the early pages of the book. It's called Horror Stories to Read Under the Sheets. And so it seems like small omissions in care of your money can lead to some big problems down the road.
Yes. So I've been doing this for a long time. And for better or worse, I've seen pretty horrific things in terms of financial mistakes. In that section that you mentioned, I talk about a client who lost $500,000 because their mother didn't file a $6 document to retitle property. I've had other clients where they get cancer when they didn't do certain planning. And what I'm seeking to do to bring out those things is to help people not make the same mistakes. And the moral of all of those stories is not that, okay, well, here's this one information, that it's impossible to have all that experience. And that it's important to lean on the experience of others. It takes a lifetime to have all this experience, and you need to have it as early in your life as possible so that you don't make those mistakes yourself.
Chad Gordon's book is called Wealth by Virtue. We'll come back and talk more with Chad about getting into those six sections of places to put your money so that it grows over time, so that it is ready for you when you are ready to stop working. You can join the conversation on The Exchange by phone or email when we come back in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is investment advisory company owner Chad Gordon, who has written a book called Wealth by Virtue that lays out six areas of helping your money grow over time: banking, investments, real estate, insurance, legal planning, and tax planning in the book. You can join the conversation on The Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So in addition to those six areas, you have some pool rules, which is to understand the six areas, number one. Two, embrace the things you can't control. And three, control what you can control. I understand one and three, but how do you embrace the things you can't control, Chad?
Sure. So there are a couple things. So pool rules, this is my own thing. If you think of swimming in a pool, if you don't follow the rules, you're going to get hurt. So some of the things you can't control is you can't control what the stock market is going to do today, tomorrow, this year, or any of that kind of thing. And so my approach is, instead of worrying about those things and spending a lot of energy trying to control something you really have no control over, is to embrace that you can't control it and not worry about it, and to instead rely on probabilities. You can control how you spend money. You can control how you behave in the stock market. And those are the things that people should really focus their energy on.
All right. And one of the things that really kind of helps us to understand the way the whole need to have your money in order as you get older is when you give some comparisons about what $100,000 buys now versus years ago is stark. Your money really does have to grow over time.
Yeah, absolutely. And even that's the opening premise of the book. Is I start off with a statement that money is to buy stuff. And because of that, everything in your financial life should be thought on in terms of what it's able to buy, its purchasing power, for lack of a better word. So the way I describe the $100,000 is, if you visualize a giant pile of stuff, and let's go back to 1965, and we all think about how maybe if you're older, you bought a house for $20,000 or something like that in that era, or you bought a car for $1,500. So if you visualize $100,000 in a giant pile of stuff and what it could buy, over time that pile would shrink and shrink and shrink until today, $100,000 would get you a car and maybe, a pile of groceries or something like that. And so the thing is, if you keep projecting that onto the future, to 30 years in the future, that pile only continues to shrink. It's the one risk that you really cannot avoid, is that no matter what you do, the prices of everything around you will be higher between now and any time in the future. And so that's the thing you can't control. So instead, that should be the number one enemy that you should be fighting against over your lifetime.
Well, then, you know, since this is in the section on banking, are banks fairly low on your priority list of where to put money?
They should. And it's common. And a lot of the reason why I start with this is often I come across people who are conservative and they're not comfortable with risk. And so what I'm seeking to do is to reframe what risk really is that your biggest risk that you can't avoid is that prices will go up. And what I illustrate in there is I show how money and banks really have never made any substantial amount of money over a lifetime. I start with someone with a chunk of change in a CD. And then once you factor in taxes and inflation, over a 50-year period in real money, that money has barely grown. And I show the historical data from that and why money in banks really never goes uphill at all in any amount of money. It doesn't grow in purchasing power. It just stays the same usually over time.
So what happened? I mean, I think my first savings account when I was 11 or so earned something like 4 or 5% interest.
Sure. Well, and so when I was growing up in the 80s, my first account, I'll even one up you there, my first account earned 9.5%.
Wow.
In 82 or something like that. But you probably also know, Jeff, in that era what inflation was at the time. That was the era of double-digit inflation. And so if you just, for simple math, let's say you had a 10% CD in the early 80s, and let's say you paid 25% in taxes, you're going to end with 7.5%. And if inflation is more than that, you've literally gone nowhere in terms of your ability to grow your purchasing power. And it's the same thing in every single year. So if you were to year, you could probably look up in my little chart what that rate was. Once you factor in taxes and inflation, you don't go anywhere in your purchasing power.
So that, you know, the concern about banks aside, I mean, you do see them as a good store of liquid assets. So how much cash as a percentage of income or, you know, versus your monthly expenses should you keep on hand in liquid assets at any time?
So here's the thing. There are a lot of rules for that. You could say 6 months of living expenses. You can say they're a certain percent of your income. I think it's always more nuanced than that. But I would say, if you look at your liquid cash flow and how much you have in fixed income, and look at how much you have it's hard to give a quick answer. But basically, if you look at your fixed income, so let's say you have $2,000 a month coming in from Social Security, and you need another $1,000 per month in investments, and you multiply that by 24, that's roughly how much you should have liquid. But if you have other sources of liquidity that are roughly liquid, like in conservative bonds, I think it's fine. The volatility of those probably isn't going to be an issue for your emergency needs. But it's hard to say. It depends on if you own several houses, if you have expensive cars. It's hard to give a number, but I gave a rough number in the book based on people's circumstances.
Chad Gordon is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's an investment advisor and owns his own company in Colorado. He's written a book called Wealth by Virtue, and you can join the conversation as we talk about banking, investments, real estate, insurance, legal planning, and tax planning. Questions and comments, welcome at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. So we move into investments, and here's where you talk, Chad, about the time value of money, which means what?
Sure, the time value of money, this is an old finance term. Basically, it's how much your money grows when time is applied to it. So some of you may have heard of things of like the rule of 72, of how fast it takes for things to double. But really what I'm punctuating is that time when it's on your side, and the incredible power of time when it's on your side for it to double. And what this is doing is this is teeing us off to go into the investment section for when we abandon the thought that banks are a ultimately long-term safe place to keep money, and to realize how do we navigate into this world to grow our purchasing power in a safe-ish way.
So here's a critical point, though. I mean, if you wait until you're into your 40s or something, can you catch up on the stuff you didn't set aside in your early years?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's no substitute for lost time. But I would say that even when you're 40 years old, well, what's your life expectancy? Say it's 85 years old by that point. So you still have 45 years to go between today and the day you'll likely pass away. So while you may be 20 years from retirement, you still have plenty of time to really grow your money and do the things you should have been doing 20 years ago. But there's also obviously the message for us to be talking to young people is there's no time like the urgent. I gave a terrific example of two twins where the first twin starts saving money on her 21st birthday and the other twin doesn't save any money until his 30th birthday. And she stops saving money on the 30th birthday. So in other words, she's saving up money for about 9 years and he starts on that ninth year and she has more money than him by the time the two twins are 100 years old. And it's hard to get verbally over the radio, but basically that is the message we should be telling young people to start now and to force them to start now as easy as possible.
Those are some fairly effective anecdotes in the book. I do remember that one particularly well. You do say you want to foster a faith in the stock market, but I know some people seem to be leery of it. It looks like investors get all kinds of whims and hissy fits and psychology rules the day. But so then how do you make the case for faith in the stock market?
Sure. Well, obviously we're going through some unusual times in our history, but what I paint in the pictures, I have a chart of the last 90 years, and it's the chart of scary things. And what I do is I go through history and I look in that year and try to pick out the scariest thing that I could think of, or what I would say is the biggest reason why someone should not have invested money in that year. And then in the right column, I have a dollar that was invested in the S&P 500 and showing the growth of that dollar over time. So as you're taking through history, you're seeing all the events of World War II, you're seeing all the events of the Cuban Missile Crisis or the oil embargo or whatever wars along the way and crises along the way or natural disasters. But the stock market has an odd callousness to our daily worries. And there's always the apocalypse du jour and always things to be scared of. But the message that I'm saying is that there's no shame in being scared of the events of the day. What I'm saying is what you should be doing is ignoring them. And what I contrast later in the book is I say there's always the Eeyores and the Pollyannas. The Eeyores are always saying, well, thanks for noticing me. That's what Eeyore always said. But he always has an air of pessimism. He's always seeing the downside of things. And we all have friends like this. And then there's the Pollyannas. You may remember the Disney film where she was all cheesy and optimistic. And she was always ignoring and always saw the bright side of things. And of course, it's a ridiculous contrast. But the case that I make is the Pollyannas, the ones who ignore the downside and the negative things and all the things that you may be completely rationally afraid of, that you do better in the end by simply ignoring them and looking out the window of the bus the whole time.
And one of the most fascinating cases you put here is you put worst year, best year comparisons in the market, and they are often adjacent years, aren't they?
Right. And that's more of the irony, I guess, of declines. And we can look at this in recent history. So the financial crisis was about 10 years ago, starting this fall. And it bottomed out in March of 2009. And so if you look at the 12 months before that, it was down roughly 34%, if I remember right. If you looked at the whole thing, it was down 57%. But if you fast forward the time after March 2009, it recovered roughly half the decline in only 12 months or so, and the whole thing was wiped out in only a matter of years. And the same thing in the Depression, the same thing with almost every decline, is that the worst times are always preceded by the best times.
Chad Gordon's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Wealth by Virtue, about how to grow your money over time. You can join the conversation on the exchange with questions and comments. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So, Chad, what is your usual advice on entry into the stock market? Should it be mutual funds, some other tool in which you share stock ownership with other people?
Sure. Well, I mean, I do have an answer to that. But what I'd say before that, a refrain I say in the book is that the specifics of how you invest are not nearly as important as how you invest. In other words, the fact that you invest at all is the most important thing. And your ability to stay in the market during scary times is just as important. Now, whether it's a mutual fund or whether it's an ETF, whether it's individual stock, is pretty far down the list of importance on it. But to answer the question, the way that I personally invest with my clients are ETFs. So they're exchange-traded funds. What that means is you can trade them throughout the day, but it's similar to a mutual fund where it's a basket of stocks instead of individual stocks. But mutual funds are typically fine. I think I would add to that just be cautious of the cost of the fund and look at what value they're delivering for the cost that they're charging.
I've noticed a fair number of people talk about that, where you got to watch out for the fees and things that come with the mutual funds.
Right, yeah. It's a very important thing. It's more of just saying valueless fees is the thing I would look at. So If a mutual fund is charging a bunch of money, usually mutual funds, to my mind, charge money that you could be paying to someone who would also do financial planning and do portfolio management and deliver more value for you for the same cost, if that's the route you wanted to go. But again, the thing I would say more than anything is, even with fees, even if you had a very expensive mutual fund, but you were able to buy into it early in your life and hold on to it, you're going to do better than someone who's investing later and being very fee conscious.
Chad, let's move into the section of the book on real estate. Again, we have banking, investments, real estate, insurance, legal planning, and tax planning as the six sections of the book. So we get into real estate. This is the part of the book that talks about the personal inflation rate. What do you mean by that?
So this is something I came up with. The epiphany that I had was I had clients who had very, very different standards of living and very different lifestyles based on where they were. So if you look at the inflation rate, say it's 3% or so. But if you're in long-term care, your inflation rate is going to be driven by medical costs and that kind of thing. Or if you're on the other end of the spectrum and your house is paid off and you're living frugally and you can imagine a scenario where basically the things you're spending money on are not going up in price as other people. And so the magical thing with real estate is that one of the biggest chunks of the national inflation rate is shelter. It's about 33% of what makes up that number. But the cool thing is that when you buy a house, basically you're freezing that number for yourself. And so your personal inflation rate suddenly drops from 3% down to, say, 2% or something like that, because that part of your monthly expenses is no longer going up as much as it was as someone who was renting their house.
And we have an email in the real estate section from Becca in Lane County who says, some people say you shouldn't pay off your mortgage because of the tax deductions. I don't agree. I feel like it's the best thing I've ever done. Do they have a point, or does she, I guess, is the larger question.
Sure. Well, there's always the math answer, and then there's the real world answer. So I'll give you the math answer because the real world answer is a little more sticky. So the math answer is the benefits of paying off your mortgage. There's two things. Is number one, so if you pay off your mortgage and you don't get the mortgage deduction anymore, you get the standard deduction. So the whole thing of losing your mortgage deduction is a way overblown concern. It's really not a big deal. That's not the reason to do it, especially with the latest tax thing that went through last year. It's all the more, your standard deduction is now double what it was before. So that's not the issue at all. The problem of paying off your mortgage is the opportunity cost of that money and had it been invested in the market. So the mathematical answer is it's better not to pay off your mortgage, with a gigantic caveat if you are disciplined in your investing strategy. So if you're taking that same money that you would be doing to pay off your house and investing it in the market and keeping it invested, then that actually does better. But the real world answer is that psychologically paying off your house feels really good.
Ah, okay. So what you're saying is then make sure that the money that you were sending to the mortgage doesn't just get spent now, but saved up for something later?
Well, and that's always the rub, is that very few people are disciplined and very few people will actually say, okay, this money I was using to pay off my house, I'm going to invest it in the market. Very few people do that. And so, again, the real world answer is that it depends on who the person is more than anything.
Well, and so, okay. Yeah, so this brings us to a point in the book where, and again, this is a book about maximizing wealth, but you riff for a while in the real estate section about minimalism. What kind of minimalism?
Sure. Well, so it's quite simple. I mean, and again, there are things in the book that I feel are a little bit ironic and feel out of place, because usually books about getting wealthy do not talk about not spending money. But to not spend money is to be wealthier. If you have one person who has less of monthly needs and has a more simple lifestyle, they can have the same peace of mind, I believe, as someone who has more money and a more expensive lifestyle. And so really what I'm seeking to do is to put a balance in this, is that I don't think it's necessarily a humanistically healthy thing for you to aspire to just be wealthy and that's the end of it. I think you should always be looking at the psychology behind it and looking at, does this actually do anything for me and increase the things that really mean something, like the relationships in your lives.
Well, and in fact, later in the section about legal planning, you talk about your goal should always be to maximize the return on your investment, even if the return is intangible, and which is, that's a little, yeah, again, surprising. I mean, you're getting beyond just the dollars and cents and often to things that make you feel good as a human being, I guess.
Yeah, sure, exactly. And there's a lot of things that on it, even something as dry as legal planning, has a lot of very emotional things to it. So, for example, I had a client whose parents passed away in the over the last couple of years, and him and his brother and sister inherited about $6 million or so. And so they're splitting it up. And lo and behold, 2 years after the last one passed away, they're suing each other for inheritance because the parents didn't do proper legal planning. And even though you don't think of an estate plan as an emotional thing and something that could create peace and happiness in a family, this is a very good example of that, because the mom didn't do a couple things, it's tearing the family completely apart. And so at some point, it's not necessarily about getting wealthier, but it's also about keeping things as a down-to-earth level.
Well, the book really does sort of get under your radar because, again, it does look like a kid's book on the cover with this wonderful color cover of the bull and the bear enjoying each other's company under the night sky. But it is not a kid's book. It's a book for adults, but written in a very accessible way. It is called Wealth by Virtue. It's the work of Chad Gordon, who is the founder and CEO of an investment advisory company in Colorado. Chad, thanks for writing the book, and thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you for having me.
Very much pleasure.